Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio. I'm Dave Custy, and my guest today is Laura Daugherty, President and CEO of the Baltimore Curriculum Project. Laura Daugherty has served as President and CEO of the Baltimore Curriculum Project since July 2012. Daugherty became interested in teaching at an early age. Her mother was a special education teacher, and Daugherty grew up hearing and adopting the philosophy that anyone can be taught to read. In 1994, she began teaching and eventually consulting in the Chicago Public Schools. From 1996 to 1997, Daugherty served as headmaster and teacher at the Baraka School, an innovative boarding school in Kenya, Africa, for at-risk boys from Baltimore City. Since 1998, Daugherty has worked as a trainer for the Association for Direct Instruction and has been invited to speak at the ADI National Conference every year. She has trained both new and experienced direct instruction teachers around the country in reading, math, comprehension, and writing. As a National Institute for Direct Instruction consultant working with the Baltimore Curriculum Project since 1997, Daugherty has led and managed all aspects of the direct instruction implementation for reading, math, writing, spelling, and U.S. history in three BCP neighborhood charter schools. She has supported BCP's successful efforts to improve education for Baltimore City's students through curriculum implementation, teacher training, in-class coaching, and data analysis. Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio, Laura.
Thank you, Dave. It's very nice to be here.
Tell me a little bit about yourself. Give me a little bio here.
Well, I have been in Baltimore for about 14 years. Didn't start here, though. I started off in Idaho as a daughter of a cattle rancher and a special ed teacher, and really never dreamed that I'd end up in Baltimore, Maryland. But I think, like a lot of people who come here, you find yourself really drawn to the city and the community, and we're just really happy to be here and don't plan on going anywhere, possibly ever again.
Very good. Very good.
Maybe vacation.
I don't know. I might hold you to that. You know, this is recorded and we archive this show.
Oh,
so
no.
In years from now, when you're moving to Idaho or somewhere, you're thinking, oh, my
goodness. When we retire. But yeah, Baltimore does have a special character about it that you find yourself wanting to get involved and help be part of the fixing of the problems and the excitement of a city that is has a lot of wonderful things going on.
And it leads us to BCP. Tell me about the evolution with you in BCP.
BCP was started with some very generous support from the Abel Foundation back in 1996. A woman named Dr. Muriel Berkeley wanted to start a project where they would be able to put really good tools in the hands of teachers. She was a teacher herself for middle school students, and I think she was a very good teacher, but she always wished she could have done more and been better. And so she wanted to take this on as a way to bring everything that teachers need to be successful with kids. And through her work on this grant, she came across a curriculum called Direct Instruction, which has been around since the late 60s and has more effectiveness data on it than I think any other program out there, partly because it's been around for so long and partly because it is particularly effective. And so she thought, well, let's, among other things, let's bring direct instruction to our schools to teach kids to read and to do math and to learn how to write. And I think at some point in those early years, they were just they were supporting schools who wanted to use it. She went around, spoke to schools, spoke to staff, spoke to community groups. And at one point, I think 21 schools were using direct instruction with support from BCP. And that support was in the form of coaching and some training and just kind of generally helping get the programs going. There were no charter schools back then. When the charter schools came into existence about 2005, we became the operators of some of the schools that were using direct instruction, and that's where we are today. We operate three really wonderful schools right here in Southeast Baltimore. We have Wolf Street, which is right up the street, Wolf Street Academy. Terrific principal there named Mark Gaither. There's Hampstead Hill, which is just south of Patterson Park. The principal there is Matt Hornbeck. And then we have City Springs, which is closer to Little Italy. And the principal there is Rhonda Ricchetta. And those are three true professional, great leaders. They've managed to put together some particularly terrific staff, and we have about 1,600 kids that we're educating right now in our three schools.
So it's basically here in East Baltimore.
Southeast Baltimore. Yeah, we're not against other parts of the city, but that's where we are at the moment.
Talk a little bit about direct instructions, research-based reading curriculum. You have it in 18 Baltimore City schools, but you said that started with the Able Foundation support and all. Talk a little more detail on what that is.
There's what we call small D, small I direct instruction, which is just a way of teaching where you break things down in component parts, and you could teach tennis using direct instruction where you show kids. It's sort of teacher-led, small incremental bits. What we're talking about when we say direct instruction is a particular curriculum. The reading program is called Reading Mastery. The math program is called Connecting Math Concepts. But it's a published program that started off, like I said, I think back in the late 1960s, and the man who designed it looked at what poor readers did and designed a program to prevent those things from happening. For example, BD reversals. If you go in alphabetical order, B and D are two letters apart. They're pretty abstract symbols, and if you introduce them that closely together, there's a pretty good chance kids are going to have some confusion about B's and D's. Whereas if you carefully sequence how you introduce sounds and letters, they're going to be further apart. So by golly, they know what a duh is before they get to a buh because it's 60 lessons apart or something like that. So they really an incredible amount of thought and engineering went into designing the program. And then it was field tested more than you could even imagine. They would take it out into classrooms with kids, see what the problems the kids were still having, bring it back, revise it, take it out, try it out again. So by the time the teacher gets the tool in their hand as a published product, it has been proven to be successful in front of real kids with real teachers.
So you've used that as a foundation for BCP, or just learned from it?
Well, one of our principals described direct instruction as the engine that drives the rest of the instruction and the curriculum. We also use core knowledge, which is a very content-rich, carefully sequenced, where what they're learning in kindergarten, as far as content goes, is built upon in the first grade, and the second grade, and the third grade, so that you kind of know what the things are that the kids are learning, social studies and science, so that you build on that, too.
So talk about your evolution with BCP.
I started as president in July of 2012, but I've been working in BCP school since 1999 when we first moved here. And for all of those years up until a little over a year ago, I was focused particularly on the curriculum and on what was happening in the classrooms and training teachers and coaching teachers and looking at data, just helping problem solve basically at the school level and helping with the scheduling and kind of keeping the academic portion of it as effective as we could make it. And then when Dr. Berkeley retired, she retired, sadly. She's still on the board, though, so she's still a very active part of BCP. I took over for her, and then I had to do a lot more things. a little less in the classroom, and then I had to look at financial spreadsheets and fun things like that.
Well,
so, yeah.
I know what that's like. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in your 14 years there, let's talk about what it was like in 1999 and how it has emerged today.
There a couple of things have become clear. That when Dr. Berkeley first got started, I'm going to take City Springs as an example.
Okay.
It was such a rough place to be for kids and adults that PBS did a documentary about it called The Battle of City Springs. It really showed how hard it was to get the kids on board, get the staff on board, and moving forward in a positive manner. So it was really a lot of hard work. The staff has gone through a lot of changes back in those early years because, you know, change is hard for everybody. And
sure,
through the years, the staff has stabilized. The implementation has become really rich and full, and they've been able to add a lot more pieces to it. So the first few years where you're trying to get everybody up to speed on teaching direct instruction, and there's a lot of training and a lot of support that goes into that. So that's the first few years are kind of focused on that. But then through the years, you get to start doing other, you know, more things that are also important pieces. For example, I think City Springs was the first school in the city to use something called restorative practices. It's kind of a conflict resolution and relationship model, relationship building model, where you get kids and teachers talking on a regular basis and kind of prevent problems in the first place. And then when issues do arise, it's a way of resolving things that really replace suspension. Once you get a good restorative practice model going, suspensions all but go away.
Really?
Because you Yeah, and it's much better if, you know, if someone does something to you that is hurtful and they get suspended, well, that's okay. You know, that helps for a day or two. You know, they got punished. But it doesn't do anything to the relationship. When they come back, they're still going to be mad at you. You're still mad at them. But if you resolve the conflict in a way that everybody feels like, okay, I feel better about this now, then you've solved the problem for down the line. So
it sounds like each party involved is treated with respect. Mm-hmm. And so they can engage in that. And if you really make somebody feel good about something, it works better in the long run.
Well, and if someone does something to harm you, whether it's physical or mental, and then they say why they did it and whether they're sorry about it, that really helps. It helps much more than just having someone be punished without the sorry part. And there still can be consequences, but they should make sense and not just be, you know, a one size fits all. So restorative practices is something we've been able to add. We brought in, and I think actually, I'm skipping around a little, but quite a few schools in the city now use restorative practices. I think some of the people at central offices have recognized it as a valuable tool, and now it's being used in the city. Another thing that we started using many years ago, and I also believe we were the first in the city to use it, was the MAP assessment. It's produced by the NWEA, which is the Northwestern Education Association. And it's an online assessment tool that shows student growth. And so you can give it to a kid in the fall and the spring, and then again in the fall and then the spring, and you get a picture over time of whether or not a child is growing. And it's growth-based as opposed to something like the MSA, which is you pass it or you don't pass it. We found that to be really helpful in looking at growth, because if you get kids into your school, which we get quite a bit depending on the school, who are operating 2 to 3 years below grade level, they may still not pass the MSA, but they may show quite a bit of growth that lets the school know and the teachers know and the parents know that what should be happening with the child is happening. Happily, the Baltimore City has also approved use of the NWEA for assessments for charter schools, and are encouraging other schools to use it as well. Because it's a nice stable measure as we're going from the MSA to the park next year. There could be some, you know, it's hard to, you're using completely different tests. So typically what's been happening nationwide is that scores drop. Well, all right, well, did we do a worse job, or is it just a different assessment tool? Now we have to kind of recalibrate. The NWA will give us some stability in kids' achievement.
So when you first started out, how did you select the schools?
It was sort of a process of going to schools and saying, hey, here's what we want to do. Are you interested? And that usually involved talking to entire staffs, mm-hmm. and maybe parent groups. And then they would vote on it. And you don't want to go into a place where you're trying to force it on people. So they were very successful with that. But and you asked earlier about where we are now versus where we were. One thing we've learned is that even to sustain this implementation, it still takes a fair bit of coaching and training and ongoing development. You don't just put it in, get people going, and then stop supporting it, because staff change, principals change. There's always a need for new staff development, and you're always trying to make it better by, you know, looking at what current problems there are and problem solving. So a lot of the schools who initially adopted and got quite a bit of support, eventually the support wasn't there, staff had changed, and it just lost steam, I guess, and the city had new initiatives, and so most of those schools ended up not continuing it after 5 or 6 or 7 years, not because they weren't successful with it, but time marches on. The schools that stuck with us are the ones that became the charter schools and had a lot of success with it.
So now you have the schools here in Fells Point, East Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about how is it implemented in terms of, let's say, class size.
Well, give me a grade level, because it looks really different.
Let's
at
see.
Kindergarten,
I imagine
and
it would. Let's say I always like fifth grade myself.
Oh, I love fifth grade too. That's fourth is probably my favorite. But
I had Mrs. Shoemaker. She was great.
A fifth grade class would have some time spent with a reading program where they're reading novels or novel selections. By the fifth grade, a lot of the kids have gone out of the reading mastery. It's 6 years worth of material, but if you're accelerated, you get through it faster. And so by fifth grade, we have kids, some kids who are in the reading mastery, and they're doing Jack London, Mark Twain selections, novel selections. And then we have other kids who've moved on to full-blown novels. But a piece of their day is spent in literature, and another piece of their day is spent in writing. And by fifth grade, it's pretty much all expository writing that we're doing. We're getting kids to look at pieces, like look at sources of information, and then write about whether those sources of information are misleading or inaccurate or contradictory. And that's a really kind of high-level language skill. It's not narrative writing, it's expository writing, and the language that we use in expository writing is quite different than spoken language, a lot of howevers and evidence. So by fifth grade, our kids are involved in expository writing where they're creating arguments or refuting arguments. I think that's the kind of writing that really prepares them for college and high school, because, you know, in college and high school, you're analyzing pieces of information and saying whether they're valid or you agree or you disagree, and that would complete the language arts portion of the mm-hmm. fifth grade day. The math varies somewhat in our schools. One school, Hampstead Hill, is using Singapore math with great success. One school is using Connecting Math Concepts, which is another direct instruction program. So those are, you know, we vary a little bit, but they're both programs that are based on success. Like Singapore math has been around for decades, and it made Singapore one of the A-plus countries in the world with math. So they would have 80 to 90 minutes of math. And then there's spelling, and there's social studies and science that are also in there. And we're moving more towards the core knowledge of social studies and science. So
let's say you're just going into the fifth grade from another school, and your reading level is a lot less than the people that can do the expository mm-hmm. work. Mm-hmm. How does that address?
Well, when a child comes to a BCP school, our goal is to give every child a reasonable challenge every day. So whether you're 2 years above where you would be expected to be or 2 years below, we assess you when you come in and find an instructional group that works for you. So if you have a child whose decoding ability, for instance, is well below what you would expect, we would either have create a group or add that child to a group that is appropriate for that level. But then they wouldn't be there all day necessarily. They would go back with their grade level group for math, if that's appropriate, and language, if that's mm-hmm. appropriate. And so we call it flexible performance-based grouping, where we try to get kids in a position where every day they're getting challenged in a way that they can be successful. That's another part of the direct instruction piece, is that you want to make sure that no kid is bored and no kid is over their head and frustrated, that we were really careful with that, especially in the early grades, where the reading and the language instruction needs to be pretty finely tuned to what the kid is able to do. So in a kindergarten, for example, you're going to find kids who complete 200 lessons, which is more than a lesson a day, and you're going to find kids who complete 110 lessons because of how much more repetition they needed and how it took them longer to master the skills. They master the skills, and they all absolutely learn to read. Some kids go through it faster, and some kids need a little more time, but it works. It's that we want everybody being successful.
How does it work in terms of teachers? Are there specific teachers that will do the expository work, and then there are teachers that go to the kids that need some beginning work? Are there ones that are specialties in terms
of
that? Yeah,
that varies depending on the school and how many staff members. There are times where, for instance, that you'll have a 4-5 combo reading group. The kids are in that reading group for the reading period, and then they go back to their grade level grades. Or some groups stay mixed grade all day long. You know, you have a 2-3 combo and a 4-5 combo, and that's just, you know, that's just where they stay. But there are teachers who do small group instruction. So instead of going to another classroom for a reading group, they would go into a small group instruction setting for reading if that's what they need.
So they're specially trained?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we have a part of the curriculum that is, I would call it developmental, where you start, that's the 6-year-long strand. And then there's another piece called corrective reading, which is meant to accelerate kids that are below level. So if you have 4 or 5 kids who come, which we do pretty much every year, who aren't able to read at grade level, we put them in a corrective reading program. And usually within a year, we have them where we want them to be. And that's usually pretty intense small group instruction every day.
That's great. That sounds wonderful. Because you'll get kids that are poor in reading and great in math.
Yeah.
And they have to be really put into that proper segment. Mm-hmm. You have such an impressive results. Here it says 850 students tested in 2010 at BCP schools. 70.5% were proficient or advanced in reading. 69.1 in math, 72% increase in math average 2010. So it sounds like it's working very well.
It is. And we have two of our schools are what are called 80-80 schools, meaning they have at least 80% of their kids qualifying for free or reduced lunch, and they have 80% of their kids passing the MSA. And there's a handful of schools citywide that fall into that category. And two out of three of our schools do. So they're high poverty, but they're also very successful schools. We know we can move kids. We can provide them with an environment that is positive and challenging, but in a way that's encouraging and not discouraging.
Currently, are there other programs you want to talk about that you're about to implement?
Something that we've started this last summer is developing a middle school core knowledge program, because if anybody's familiar with core knowledge, there's a man named Edie Hirsch who started back in the, 20 or 30 years ago with what your child should know. There is something, what your preschooler should know, what your kindergartner should know, what your first grader should know. And I'm going to get into trouble trying to say what his thesis is, but if you teach content, you are teaching reading comprehension, because you can teach kids to decode all day long, but if they don't know what those words mean, or they don't have the sense of the context for those words, they're going to miss out. Their reading comprehension is not going to be there. Content really matters, and that you want to teach kids quality content, start it early and keep it going, so that you have kids that are culturally literate and can read a passage and know what it means and have the sense that can connect it to what they know about the world. And, we tend to agree. We had something called Leading Minds, which I'll talk about in a few minutes, but a forum recently where David Steiner, who's the former commissioner of education of New York State, said everyone's talking about critical thinking. Well, critical thinking about what? You can't think critically about nothing. You have to know things about the world to think critically about it. So the core knowledge piece is something that we are working very hard on, especially in the middle schools, because there's a scope and sequence, but there isn't a curriculum that you can hand to a teacher. So we are currently creating lesson plans, trying them out. We're field testing them and revising them over the next couple of years so that we have a tool that is useful for middle school teachers to teach all this content.
I like to approach things as a blueprint or a business plan. So what I like to ask is, how do you see the work progressing 3 months down the road, 6 months, a year, 3, 5 years? I know a lot of times you can't go and do it that far ahead, but what do you see it in a year, let's say?
I think we would like to refine our middle school curriculum, like I mentioned, with the core knowledge, and actually produce something that is a tool that we can use not just with the BCP schools, but any school that's interested in core knowledge, we could share that with them. We would like to be in more schools in next year and a few years down the line. So we're in 3 schools right now. I think in the near future, we'd like to be in 1 or 2 more schools, and then 5 years down the road, several more schools, so that we can be sharing what we think is a really strong model and works for kids. So that's a big piece of where we'd like to be down the road.
What's the kind of attention you're getting from other schools around the area or other districts?
We are very much interested in working in other schools in Baltimore City. One thing I wanted to make clear that I don't think I did earlier is that the type of charter we are is what we would refer to as a conversion charter school, meaning it's an existing neighborhood school that converts to charter status. They would benefit from the kind of support that BCP offers. So we are not a typical charter where families who are interested come citywide, put their names in a hat, and it's a lottery. We serve our neighborhoods first, and then if there are seats left over, then we go to a lottery process. So kids from outside the neighborhood can get in. But we really do like the idea of being able to teach any kid who lives within a zone, no matter what the zone is.
And you take everybody, right?
Oh, yeah. All charter schools have to take anybody. I mean, anybody can put their name in a hat. They can't exclude people based on anything from the initial lottery. But we take you know, every kid who lives in the zone gets to come to the school.
Well, Laura, is there anything else you want to add?
Yeah, I do. We have a couple of events that we put on each year that I think that are really fun for the general public, I have to say. One is the Leading Minds Forum, and we do that every year in September with our partner, Loyola University School of Education. This year, I'm going to give you an example of the kind of program that is. We had, the question was, how do we prepare new teachers for the classroom? And that discussion grew out of a report that came out this summer by the National Center for Teacher Quality, basically saying ed schools have become an industry of mediocrity. And that doesn't mean all ed schools are mediocre, but as an industry, they had a lot of the schools had low standards for letting people in. They churn out all these people. They're kind of money-making machines. And then the filter is on the classroom side, where people get in front of kids and can't do it, and they flame out. And that's not probably the way you want to go about, you know, teaching vulnerable children. So anyway, we had a really great discussion with Kate Walsh, who's the president of NCTQ, the major author on the report, and David Steiner, who's the dean of education from Hunter College in New York and the former New York State Education Commissioner, and also a guy named James Hennessy, who's the dean of the Fordham School of Education. That's another Jesuit school. And, you know, the Jesuit school said, we're not going to participate in this because we don't want to. And we think we don't disagree that there's a problem, but here's how we're working on it, and we don't want to be part of this. So it was quite a lively conversation.
Mm-hmm. I can see that. Being very polite, but I went to Jesuit school. I understand.
Yeah, so it was a really good conversation, and I think it was pretty honest on everybody's part about the problems that exist in the field, and then there were some real differences in how you go about solving those problems. So we do that annually. It's a different question every year, but we do try to bring in people from around the country who are experts on that topic. So that won't come around again until next fall. But mm-hmm. In the meantime, we have our annual Are You Smarter Than a BCP Fifth Grader event. And we match celebrities, local celebrities, with BCP fifth graders. I have to say we've won 2 years in a row. And we've both years have included Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake and CEO Dr. Andres Alonzo, as well as this year we had Maria Broom and Anirban Basu. It's really fun. Bob Heck was the MC, and he's a card. I think it's going to be this year again at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. That's in Maine. You can get information from that on our website. And it's a fundraiser, but it's, you know, I think an affordable fundraiser and a lot of fun to be at.
I would like to continue this, if you are willing to do this as an ongoing program. Hmm. And as we go live and recorded, right now I'm just recorded, I'm just starting out as the business develops, we could do networking with the people that you mentioned and plus other schools around the country and around the world. Mm-hmm. And then we just see how we can incorporate the good stuff and, you know, whatever you want to do.
All right.
Does that sound good?
It sure does. Thank you again for having me.
Give us your contact info.
All right. You can get basic information about the Baltimore Curriculum Project from going to www.baltimorecp.org. You can email me directly at ldoherty. I better spell that. LDOHERTY at baltimorecp.org. Or if you want to talk to a live person, you can call the office at 410-675-7000.
Thank you, Laura.
My pleasure.
I've been talking to Laura Doherty, the president and CEO of Baltimore Curriculum Project. I'm Dave Custy, and you've been listening to Baltimore Internet Radio.